convictions with regard to war and this war. The next one is, do your convictions fall under the provision of the draft for conscientious objection? And the third is, can you convince your draft board that that's so? Well, the first is, what do you believe yourself? And there's quite a range of opinion. We can leave out the positions of those who have no thought of being conscientious objectors, but even if you are an objector, there's quite a range of possibility. There are some who object to taking life under any circumstances, even animal life. In Tolstoy's day, some of his followers wouldn't even kill mosquitoes. And Schweitzer went so far that he would trap rats inside the compound and then take them out and let them loose. Of course, they probably wouldn't do too much damage on the outside, but his principle of reverence for life was taken to quite an extreme. There are some, of course, who are vegetarians. There are others who would not object to taking life under some circumstances, but they say that to be willing to do that does not mean that one must participate in war. The circumstances under which they might be willing to take life would be a personal incident when it meant either letting somebody else be killed or intervening, or they might be willing to do it if they were members of a police force and they recognize the police force. But they say that war is not to be compared with the exercise of police force, because the police operate under law. They are not parties to the struggle. They operate on a basis of impartiality, and their function is to suppress violence and to restore a situation in which reason can be brought back and a case can be adjudicated. But war is every nation for itself. It never has been brought under the rule of law. Now, there were some who would say that on that basis they would object to all war, or at any rate to all modern war. Now, there's been a great deal of debate as to the ethic of war and as to whether modern war can be justified, even if earlier war might have been. The code of the just war began with the Greeks, and Plato tried to restrict violence, said that the object of war was not to exterminate the enemy, but to vindicate justice and restore peace. There should be no wanton violence. Orchards should not be cut down. Wells should not be poisoned. Cicero elaborates on this and sets up a whole code for the conduct of war. War must be declared, good faith must be kept with the enemy, hostages must be properly treated, so also should prisoners of war, non-combatants should be exempt. Then this was all taken over by St. Augustine, and he formulated the ethic of war, which has prevailed for the most part in Christian history. He said the object of war, as Plato said, is to vindicate justice and restore peace. But he added that the motive must be love, and he said war was not incompatible with love because it destroyed only the body and not the soul. He said that war should be conducted only under the auspices of the state, because if the individual engages in violence, he cannot do so without anger, resentment, pride, and so on, and his behavior will not be impartial. In other words, he's thinking of war as an analogy to the exercise of the police power. He too had the whole system of exemptions of those who are not immediately involved, and of keeping of good faith, and so on. He exempted two classes from participation in war. One, the clergy, because they minister at the altar and should not be defiled by the shedding of blood. And the other, the monks, because they practiced the Sermon on the Mount to perfection, and they lived apart, and they had no wives and no weapons and no wealth. So poverty and chastity and pacifism went together. He has a vocational division. Now, to some extent, the exemption of the clergy in our own day probably goes back to that theory of St. Augustine. Well, then came the barbarian invasions. When Europe broke up, there were a great many little principalities, all claiming to be Christian and all fighting each other. The rules went by the board. Even monks and nuns defended themselves. Bishops participated in warfare. They wouldn't use swords because they abhorred the shedding of blood. They used clubs and mashed the enemy. Then came the great attempts to at least limit warfare with the peace of God and the truce of God. The truce of God limited war to special times, no fighting on weekends and on holy days, and they finally got it reduced to a summer sport. The peace of God affected those involved, and they kept enlarging the number of non-combatants. There should be no attack on pilgrims, travelers, merchants, agricultural implements, donkeys, and women traveling without their husbands unless it were their fault. Well, here the idea is limitation on war. But this all broke down because the princes, the rulers, would take the vow to do all this and not do it. Then the church raised an army to force them and punish them. And then the church army got out of hand, and kings had to raise armies to suppress the church's armies. Well, what happened was that these attempts ended in the Crusades. The Pope made a great speech in which he called on all the nobles of France to stop shearing each other like sheep and go against the infidel. And they all cried, "God wills it," and you got the Holy War. And this differed from the just war in this respect. It didn't have to be under the auspices of the state. It could be under the auspices of the church or of some inspired leader. One didn't go to war at the behest of a ruler, but one volunteered. One took the cross. And the code tended to break down because the enemy was outside the pale. He was the infidel, and he was not entitled to mercy, respect, and so on. War is more humane when God's left out of it. If it's God's war, the enemy is God's enemy, and the war is likely to be more cruel. In the Reformation period, you have a revival of pacifism with the Anabaptists, you have the just war theory with Luther, and much of the crusading idea with the Calvinists. Now comes the question of conscientious objection. St. Augustine had said that a just war requires an unjust war. One side's got to be wrong. He's the author of the war guilt theory. But the person to determine is the ruler, and the subject doesn't know enough to have an opinion, and therefore he is to do what his ruler says. But Thomas Aquinas said that the matter of the justice of a war falls under the domain of natural reason and doesn't require revelation, and anybody can have a judgment. This opens the possibility that one might decide that a particular war was not just. Luther specified one particular war which was unjust. He said, if the Elector of Brandenburg enrolled Lutherans in his army and then used them to suppress Lutheranism, he might be disobeyed. So here is the recognition, at a limited point, of conscientious objection on the ground that you know that the war is unjust. Conscience, they said, has to rest on knowledge. It is conscientia, with knowledge. In German, Gewissen. Wissen is knowing, and Gewissen is conscience. So it rests on knowledge of justice or injustice. Well, now, this whole code largely went by the board in modern times, and chiefly at the point of exempting the non-combatants. because that was very difficult to do with modern weapons. Before the atomic bomb, strategic bombing simply eliminated the whole distinction. Entire cities were annihilated, and the atomic bomb made this even more acute. In consequence, there are those who now maintain that a just war is an impossibility, that is, that all the conditions of the old just war can't be fulfilled anymore, and there's no sense in talking about it. Others are trying to revive it, and Paul Ramsey has a book recently on the just war. He thinks that you can have limited, controlled wars with restraint, though he admits that that's only possible if you maintain the balance of terror between the great powers, each of which has the capacity to use the weapons which obliterate all distinctions and all populations. Now, I think he's rather, my own opinion is that he's rather unrealistic in his assumptions, or at least he doesn't face up to their full implications. You can, of course, have a limited war inside the framework of possible unlimited war, and you've got it right now. But the threat of the unlimited hangs over you all the time. And although out of terror both sides may refrain from using the ultimate weapon, there's always the danger that they will. Moreover, if you're not willing to use the ultimate weapon, the threat loses all of its force. You may say, we'll have all of these atomic weapons, but we won't use them. Well, if the other side knows you won't use them, your threat is gone. And if you try to fool the other side into thinking you'll use them, when for yourself you've made up your mind that you won't, you're bluffing. And your bluff is very likely to be called. It seems to me that the whole theory of the balance of terror is extremely precarious from the practical point of view, whatever one may think about it from the ethical. And from the ethical, it means the willingness to do it. Otherwise, there is no deterrence. Well, now, within that framework, you can have moderately limited war, but the Vietnam War has become increasingly unlimited, with defoliation of the land, uprooting of whole villages, transporting them into concentration camps, scorching the earth, letting them go back again to a desert. This kind of business is not in accord with any of the traditional ethics of the just war. Consequently, there are some who say that although they might conceivably approve of a war which met the old code, they can't approve of this war, and some would say they can't approve of any modern war. Well, now, if one takes any one of these positions down the line, how does one stand with reference to the draft? As it now stands, there are two conditions. One is that one has to take a religious position and take one's ground on the basis of belief in a supreme being. I don't know how elastic that is. I suppose that a humanist might deny that he believed in a supreme being, but might say he believed in a supreme order, a law of nature, a very structure of the universe. He'd have some kind of an ultimate beyond man, though he might not like the word being. Now, whether a draft board or a court would allow the word being to be stretched is something, I suppose, that could be tested only in the courts. I think one could defend the position of a humanist on the ground that it's a kind of religion, even though it doesn't fit the ordinary formulae. Then the other point is that one has to object to all war, and at present there's no there's no selective conscientious objection, though a recent case opens up the possibility that that may be recognized, and efforts are made to get legislation to enact it into law, but they're not law yet. Well, if you've got to believe that you wouldn't take part in any war, in deciding for yourself what you're going to do, you've got to ask, what is war? What's the distinction between the police power and war, if you recognize the police power? Where do the limits lie? If the United Nations, for example, were to have a world police force, and if it were to use some of the weapons of war, would that be war? Or would it be police power? This question arose quite acutely in the Second World War in the case of a student at the Divinity School who refused to take ministerial exemption and refused to appear for induction and was sent to the penitentiary. He was given only 3 months because he might have gotten off with nothing if he'd used the other exemption. After it was over, he went to India, and there he found that the Indians were massacring the Muslims and corpses were 1,000 deep. He said the only thing that stopped that was the arrival of government troops, most of them Christian. He said he had come to the point where he would rather have martial law than that kind of chaos. I said, well, what is this do to your attitude toward war? He said, well, I'm troubled. But it would seem to me that kind of thing isn't war in the sense of modern war. It's essentially an exercise of the police power, and I think it would be successful with a very minimum of violence, because people don't fight to the last ditch if they're fighting somebody who's not trying to take advantage of them, but merely to keep them from destroying somebody else and bringing about a situation in which a thing can be negotiated. Even tear gas might handle it. But it raises the question again of what is war? You might say that you object to all war and still admit that kind of essentially police action, it would seem to me. But all of these are questions, of course, you've got to thrash through for yourselves. I'm asking how far your position could fit in with the formula which the law requires. And I think you could go at least that far in recognizing coercion and still say that you objected to all war. But if you say that you would be willing to fight if you thought that the interests of the United States were vitally affected, but you won't fight in Vietnam because you think they're not vitally affected, well then, the law doesn't provide, I think, for that kind of a distinction. Then there's the whole question of strategy in dealing with a board. Most of the boards are not philosophical, they're not sophisticated, they are not sympathetic. They don't want to give you conscientious objection rating, and it's best to avoid an argument if you can. The simplest arguments are the best. If you can say, God said thou shalt not kill, and that's enough for me, well, that's the most convenient thing to say to a draft board, though it's a little too simple for most of us. And if you start discussing politics, you'll get into a tangle. Well, it may seem tricky to try to avoid all these things. You mustn't say anything you don't believe, but you better not say all that you believe and simply get into a tangle from which it's very difficult to emerge. So there's the first question is, what do you believe? And the next question, does it come under the provisions of the law legitimately without hypocritical straining of the law? And finally, what do you say when you're being examined? You cannot say what you don't believe, but you can say in the briefest and simplest terms what you believe and try to avoid getting into a tangle. Well, that's as much as I have to say of it by way of introduction. I'm sure you've got a lot of problems. and concrete cases you'd like to raise.
What can you do when they throw World War II up?
When they ask you what you would have done in World War II?
I'm not sure what I would have done.
I can well understand that you wouldn't be sure of what you would have done. These are very difficult matters indeed. And if they throw at you, would have you have been willing to participate in World War II, and yet you won't do it in this war, well then they've got you on the ground, and you are on the ground of selective objection. And the law at the present moment doesn't cover it. Now, I don't know whether you're raising the question of what that does for your standing with the draft board, or whether you're asking for light on the attitude that one might have taken.
The attitude one might have taken.
Well, I was too old for military service in the second, but I still took a pacifist position and spent a great deal of time in visiting civilian public service camps of those who had their objection recognized and then were assigned to this kind of work. It was a very complex problem. For one thing, I thought the war was an unnecessary war, but then you'd say, well, it would have been unnecessary if you'd done the right thing at the right time, but you didn't, and you've got it, so then what do you do? I would say unnecessary because England and France checkmated each other. A very severe peace was imposed on the Germans at Versailles. The English speedily came to their senses and realized that they couldn't have peace if they crushed Germany, and were willing to let bits of the treaty go by the board and let Germany come up, and the French were for holding her down. Well, either policy might have prevented Hitler. If Germany had been allowed to come up, he wouldn't have had any talking point. And if the intention was to clamp down on him and it had been done quickly and immediately, he might have been snuffed. But the English gave just enough of the coming up to interfere with smashing him, and the French interfered just enough with the English desire to let Germany have the things that he was after instead of letting him take them, that it zigzagged back and forth and the conflict came about. Well, now of course the argument was, after it had happened, what then ought to have been done? I must confess I have very deep sympathy for some of my own personal friends in Germany who were in the resistance movement in Germany and ready to assassinate Hitler, involved in the plot, and barely escaped execution. One of my friends took me up the tower of the cathedral in Freiburg and pointed down. He said, that's the place where I was first imprisoned. He was involved in the plot. Those who were taken were being executed so many a morning. The next day was his turn. His wife had walked all the way from South Germany at Freiburg to say goodbye. The group scheduled for the next morning had the Lord's Supper that night. The next morning the Russians broke in and they were liberated. Well, I have profound respect for that man, and I understand how acute a problem it was inside of Germany. Well, now from the outside, people said, well, you had to fight Hitler to save the Jews. Well, we did fight Hitler and we didn't save the Jews. And we could have saved the Jews if we'd been less willing to let them go anywhere. Hitler wasn't concerned to gas them. He was concerned to get rid of them. And for a long time, they were allowed to go. But nobody would take them on any large scale. So to say that we ought to have done it to save them, when we did do it and didn't save them, and could have saved them if we'd done it some other way, takes a lot of the ethical argument out of the conflict for me. Well, I don't know that I will spend too much time on justifying why I took that attitude then, I do admit that it's a complicated matter, and I can understand that you might not be sure of what you would have done then, and yet feel you don't want to, you won't do this particular thing. But if so, the law doesn't cover your case unless, well, as I say, there's been this one recent decision, I've forgotten its exact terms, and it may open the door to a selective attitude.
Oh, I think I know what you're talking about. This is the Central Committee was involved with this, Karpatkin, I think. The question was, what does the word any participation, any in the phrase participation in all wars, or any participation in wars, modify? And it was decided, I think it was in Massachusetts, that the word is all or any modifies participation and not wars. So there is a selective objection has not been outlawed. Somebody just won a selective objection case. It was recently in Massachusetts.
Yeah, I still don't understand it exactly. What's the exact phraseology?
That's the trouble. I can't remember it. It says you have to be opposed to any participation in war, whatever the exact phrase is, and everybody had assumed that any modified wars and not participation. But it modifies participation and not wars. So what they're talking about in the phrase is not whether you will participate in any war, but whether you will consent to any participation in a war.
Oh,
and
well, that, I think, that, wouldn't that cover...
That's covering the question of being a medic, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, sure. Well, they have allowed conscientious objectors to be medics right straight along from the First World War on down. They would take medical service. That was allowed. So there's nothing really new involved there.
Well, what's new is that the court has clarified the misunderstanding that many draft boards have held about the phrase, where draft boards have felt that the word any or all or whatever it is modified wars and not participation. And so now it is possible to be a selective objector. I read a news bulletin from the CCCO just before, well, in June it was. And apparently this opens the door. The CCCO was very jubilant about it.
Well, now let me see if I get it now. Before, you could have a choice with regard to the character of your participation as to whether it was medical or military. How did the old law read? You must be opposed to...
It's the same phrase always.
The same phrase?
It's just the court interpreted the phrase.
What was the old phrase?
The phrase is you have to be conscientiously opposed... Oh, I didn't remember exactly now. You have to be conscientiously opposed participation in war in any form.
Oh.
Now the in any form was assumed by many draft boards to modify war, but the court, as in Massachusetts or Pennsylvania, said no, it modifies participation. So you have to be conscientiously opposed to participation in any form in a war. Now that might change some things about being a medic. Whether it does or not, I don't know, but this was just a very recent decision in May or June.
Yeah, I knew there was such a decision, but I was muddy as to just what it said, and I'm afraid I was a little mud there yet.
you don't have to be opposed to participation in war, in any war.
In any war. You don't have to be opposed to participation in any war, but
right.
If you go into the war... Wait a minute.
You have to be opposed to any form of participation.
It leaves it open so that some sorts of war you don't have to be opposed to. But once you have a war, you have to be opposed to any kind of participation in that war.
In order to
That's
be given an exemption.
Like, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh.
You know, so you choose the war, and then you're against all participation. You know, once there's a war. But it doesn't mean you have to be opposed to participation in any kind of war that comes along.
Uh-huh.
It seems to me that from what the Marshall Commission has said, that what they are doing is changing the original purpose of the legislation, what this court has done.
Mm-hmm.
But beyond that, I don't know anything.
By shifting the emphasis in the phrase, they're opening up the possibility that you might be opposed to a particular war.
That's right.
Without having to be opposed to every war.
That's how this case was won on this point. A selective objector was allowed to have the CO status.
I see. Well, let us rejoice in the victory of casuistry.
Well, there's just been another case.
It's
that
a clever interpretation.
No.
Right.
No.
Well, if it gets there, why, there's nothing to be said for it.
There's a test case from the Lutheran point of view up right now.
Is there?
For the position, official position adopted in May or June of 68 at the Atlanta Conference of the LCA. And there's a test case up for that right now.
Well, can you give us a little more detail on that? How does the law get involved on this?
It hasn't gotten very far. It was turned.
What's the point that's being contested or tried?
It's the just war, and this being an unjust war. That's, I don't know very much about it. I just know the person who's up court, and he's in a lot of hot water.
Well, it involves the same point then, whether he can have exemption regarding this war as an unjust war.
Well, this case is not concentrating on the law. This case is taking that case that was proven in May or June, and now approaching the question of selective objection from a very Lutheran point of view. In other words, the Lutheran point of view, the point of view adopted at this Atlantic.
Well, is this a church court that's judging it, or a civil court?
It's a civil court, but it's just a test case of Martin Luther's criteria, as far as I understand. I don't know. I'm not sure about it.
You mean they're trying the case
yet
as to whether Martin Luther could get by the draft board? I'm not quite clear what the issue is.
The Lutheran Church, at their convention in Atlanta, adopted their own resolution on grounds for selective conscientious objection. It was a very exact and precisely worded phrase. I don't know what it was, but it was a new set of criteria for what selective conscientious objection could be, and I think maybe this is what is now up for the court. Is this an acceptable ground?
Oh, it was like Luther's point that there was one particular case in which he would allow it, and they may have had a lot more. And now the question is whether these various reasons would be sufficient for assigning a CO status.
Right.
Is that the point?
Yeah,
I get it. Right. And that's still pending.
What, this case?
The Lutheran case.
Well, it really got bogged down in all sorts of administrative troubles, unfair practices, etc., by the draft board.
I see.
It hasn't really reached it hasn't been tested on the ideological grounds yet.
In the courts?
In the courts.
Right.
That's coming up in August or something.
I see.
Late August.
Right. The Spock and the Coffin case has been split in two because Spock has been exonerated, but Coffin has simply been given a new trial. I think he's probably glad because he'd like to push the case to the Supreme Court and get a verdict on the issues involved and not merely on the technicalities of it. He tried to force the court to debate the rightness or wrongness of the Vietnam War. And the judge said, and I think rightly, we're not trying that. We're asking whether or no you impeded selected service. But now whether Coffin will be able to shift the matter and pull the debate around to the issue that's important remains to be seen.
I don't think the issue there was so much either whether they impeded the selected service. Didn't they try them and convict them for a conspiracy?
Yeah, but it was a conspiracy to elect.
So indefinite.
It was a conspiracy to impeach elect service.
But it was this phrase, conspiracy that had them.
Yeah, but it wasn't conspiracy to, for an armed attack on the United States or anything like that. It came under the charge of having interfered with the Operation Selective Service, and then that they had conspired to do it. Spock made fun of that. He said we couldn't very well have conspired. He usually have to get together to do that. And he said most of us hadn't met each other until we got the trial. But then, as I say, they've let him out on it. Coffin said he hadn't counseled anybody to be a conscientious objector or to burn his draft card. He had simply said that if he came to that conclusion, he should be backed up and supported in the carrying out of his own decision. Now, they could argue that even saying that encouraged men to do it. But if that's the point, well, there are thousands of people in this country who ought to be brought to trial too.
I think though that this whole thing was brought up for no other reason now, because these men, as I understood it or as I read somewhere, weren't even aware. I mean, the indictment wasn't brought against them, you know, brought out to them immediately. In fact, I think some of them read it in the newspaper first, their names, that they hadn't been indicted, you know, in the uh-huh. indictment or whatever, that this hadn't been brought out to them, you know, as it should have been done, and probably was done simply to cover up what General Hershey had done in the first place when he came out with this rather radical statement that anyone who opposed the draft should be classified 1A.
Mm-hmm.
And this caused, of course, a lot of complaints from people who thought that the draft board then was acting as a judge and jury, you know, as to whether you were opposing the draft or impeding the Selective Service or anything like that. And he made kind of a blunder here. And to cover this up, they go out and drag these men in, put them up on trial, and to kind of maybe cover up here.
Well, that's a psychological explanation. It may be valid, it may not. But Coffin certainly had gone down to Washington and supported public destruction of cards and so on, and Berrien, the Jesuit priest, had been convicted and imprisoned earlier because of a raid on the card files and their destruction. And there wasn't any immediate connection, I should think, between that and Hershey's case. And the Hershey case, pardon me?
Could I ask a more general question? As a pacifist, but I'd say particularly in the light of World War II, do you feel that to be a pacifist is an individual matter for one's own conscience, or do you feel that is, speaking from your own point of view, do you feel that it is the duty of a pacifist to win others to your cause? In other words, to attempt to make the whole nation a pacifistic nation?
I think it's quite legitimate to win others to your cause, but I think it's preposterous to suppose that you'll ever make a pacifist nation. You may build up the Fellowship of Reconciliation in membership by a few thousand. That's as far as it's very likely to go. So I would make a distinction between a personal stand, which is a witness, and the advocacy of a public policy. I think it's entirely legitimate to appeal to those who are in government to act according to the best self-interest of the country and their own best assumptions. Now, you may say that's not fair because you're riding two horses, but I'm willing to try to ride both of them. John Bright was a Quaker who was in English Parliament practically all of his public life. He opposed every war in which England was involved, but always on grounds of public policy. And people knowing that he was a Quaker said, "You're not playing fair. You've got an absolute up your sleeve." He said, "Yes, but I don't need to take it out." He said, there are enough relative arguments against this from the point of view of Britain's own welfare so that I don't need to pull the other out. So I would say on the basis of your own assumptions, what is being done in Vietnam is simply appalling. There's not much use talking pacifism to Nixon, even if he did have a Quaker mother. But one might discuss with him American foreign policy.
What if there was a very strong feeling that war was to the national self-interest? That was a pretty powerful argument. So would you seek to destroy destroy this position on that ground, or would you then revert to your, pull your ace out of your sleeve?
If it came
or do you feel historically there is no such thing as a justified war, or there is no such thing as a war that was for the national interest of a specific country at a specific time?
That's an historical question that involves an evaluation of each war.
Right.
And I won't say there was never a war which didn't accrue in some measure, perhaps to the advantage of a country. I can't think of a single American war that I think did anything any good in particular. Even the Revolutionary War, I don't think it would have been a calamity to have stayed inside the British Commonwealth. And I think Patrick Henry's bombastic rhetoric was sheer nonsense. And the War of 1812 was highly unpopular on the Atlantic seaboard, and Lincoln condemned the Mexican War. The Civil War is a more serious matter because it involved the ethical issue of slavery. But there are revisionists now who are saying that more patience could have brought about the result without the war and the frightful period of Reconstruction that followed. For much of the problem with which we're now dealing stems right out of the terrible Reconstruction days. Spanish-American War was largely cooked up by the Hearst papers, and the First World War was in part due to atrocity tales about the Germans, which were later proved false. The Second World War was a more complicated one, and there was more to be said for our participation, but that it accrued to our national advantage. Well, of course, it's landed us in a position of chief power in the world, but is that a national advantage? Well, you may say that my opinions determine my slant on history.
Right.
To some extent, they probably do. I hope I can face facts if they're facts, but one needs to examine pretty closely the outcome of wars to say how contagious they were. The one for which I think I have perhaps the greatest sympathy is the independence of the Dutch Republic against the real tyranny of Spain. As for the English Civil War,
the Jewish revolt against the Romans.
The Jewish revolt against the Romans?
Well, or against the Greeks, particularly.
Well, that again is complicated. It is true that the maintenance of Jewish monotheism was largely due to Jewish exclusivism and the readiness, even by war, to resist assimilation. If the Maccabees had not been so fanatical, Judaism might have been absorbed into the melting pot of world religions. Now, whether it would have lost all of its biting edge in that case is another question. Even despite those wars, the fusion of the Jewish and the classical elements took place. Philo Judaeus brought them together, and the two strands have made up the warp and woof of the world view of the Western world, by the fusion of the Jewish and the classical. So I'm not sure we had to have the Maccabean struggle in order to save Yahweh.
I think a fundamental question, I don't have the answer to, because it keeps bugging me, is why did we have all these wars? And why were so many of them inspired by such at least lofty sentiments, at least in the rhetoric of the time?
That was chiefly
justified and Christian by religious authority, and not only Christian, but there were had been other holy wars besides the Crusades.
Well, it was largely the Jews' fault. I mean, the Old Testament, the idea of the holy war, comes right there. the three most intolerant religions in the world are Judaism and her two daughters, Christianity and Mohammedanism. And they're the ones who have had holy wars because they believe not simply that God is on their side, but that they are on God's side. And therefore, let Yahweh whet his glittering sword and exterminate the Amalekites and the Jebusites and all the rest of them. As I said, war is more humane if you leave God out of it. Well, you ask, why can people become so fanatical that they think they're fighting God's wars? Now, the Greeks, of course, thought the gods were in the wars, but that a particular god came down to help a particular tribe. The god was sort of an assistant to a human group. But in Judaism, it is that the Jews have a command from Yahweh to carry out his behest. Why do people become so fanatically attached and absolutely sure of their rightness? Well, that gets you back to the whole theory of man. It's pretty hard to answer. Of course, you may answer it on religious grounds, that God, as a matter of fact, did choose this people and did call upon them to exterminate those who didn't submit. That's a pretty cruel picture of God. But then God does allow some very dreadful things to happen and doesn't intervene. But that may get back to the question of the depravity of man.
Wasn't war considered more honorable up until about the Civil War?
Well, in the 18th century, war was more restrained because Europe had a group of powers fairly equal in strength with a common culture, none of them desiring the extermination of the other, and the old just war theory took on some reality in the Europe of the 18th century, and war was conducted according to rules and with a certain degree of etiquette. And the English and the French met, and the French commander would say, "You shoot first." The English commander, "Oh no, you shoot first." They tried to overcome each other, not by fighting, but by maneuvering. Swift said, "The art of war is the art of dodging." If they did meet, they might have a pretty bloody encounter. They had so far improved the state finances that they could pay their soldiers and keep them from pillaging. So that war actually was more restrained, more cultivated, if war can be, and more according to the rules in 18th century Europe than it had been in the 30 Years' War and the Wars of Religion the previous period. And what broke it down in some measure was the American Civil War, which was another crusade and included Sherman's march through Georgia and scorched earth, which shocked even Bismarck. So there was a period of comparative limitation on war in Europe of the 18th century, and it broke down. Some say that the warfare of the white man with the Indians helped to bring it down because they didn't know the rules. And they just engaged in dirty guerrilla warfare. So the two factors together, a religious crusade and fighting with an enemy who didn't have the code, may have done something to make war less restrained. I hesitate to say civilized, as if war could ever be civilized. Yes?
Hey, Dr. Bain, if you find your country under attack, say for whatever reason, whether it's a stupid reason or not, and you find that you have to, your country decides to mobilize an army to fight off the attackers, what position does the individual Christian take, whether he's a pacifist or not, in this situation? It seems to me that World War II sort of fell into this category, but take a hypothetical case, what do you do then?
Well, if you're not a pacifist, there isn't. It's pretty obvious you're going to use arms to resist. If you are, the question is what kind of resistance. I would certainly join a resistance movement, but I would try to keep it to forms of non-cooperation, possibly economic sabotage. If a country conquered this country, I would join up with resistant movements of this kind. I would find it very difficult to engage in guerrilla resistance and assassination. You must remember that even when your country is invaded, there are limitations. If civilians take arms and shoot the invaders, then there will be reprisals, and maybe 50 will be shot for one. It's only those in uniform who can shoot without provoking that kind of retribution. My point being that if a civilian found enemy soldiers in the street and started sniping at them, the result would be pretty drastic. Now, of course, you would say he doesn't need to do that. He can be in uniform and resist in that fashion. That, of course, is true. I know I should find it very hard not to engage in military resistance if the thing came as close as that. If I followed my principles, I think I'd have to limit myself to less violent kinds of resistance.
Dr. Bing, could I ask that while you were doing that, would you hope that other people would join the military?
Well, that is a sort of an inward conflict. I went to France in the First World War with the Quakers and worked with civilians in France, and on the way over, the ship in which we were taken, part of the way, had some convoy, and I did feel inclined to hope that Providence would make the convoy effective. Now, whether I should have entertained any such hopes, I'm not sure, but I will confess to them. Well, this is true, yes, that if there is a conflict, I wouldn't say that one side is as bad as another. And even if I didn't participate, I would hope that one side would be victorious rather than the other. I didn't want the Germans to win in the First World War or Hitler in the Second. And you say, well, I'm very inconsistent then, if I have that hope and yet won't get in and help it to the uttermost. It is a conflict.
Seems to me like that's trying to distinguish, you know, degrees of sin. Now, you say that I can join the underground and I can do sabotage, maybe, or something like this. Now, I don't know if you want to go this far, if you just want to print pamphlets that are maybe going to get people to hate or whatever the case might be, but I can't go out and put on a uniform, or I can't go out and actually kill or shoot at the enemy, and we're speaking in terms of sin. Now, it seems to me that God is going to be displeased, whatever you're doing. I mean, if this is the way you feel, you know, this is sin here involved, man is going to be displeased in different degrees. I don't think God is. God is going to be displeased to me. It seems to me that sin is sin. I don't care whether you go out and kill someone or whether you, you know, just really hate him in your mind and you let him know as much. God sees it that way, I think. My interpretation. Man, you know, he places degrees on sin. Now I can go out and hate somebody in my mind and let him know it, and man probably will not punish me, whereas I go out and kill him, I'm going to be put in prison or something like this. And is this what you have here? Are you talking in terms of degrees of sin, then?
Well, I don't think you can be lily-white pure. Whatever you do, you're involved. It is a question of drawing lines, and one person will draw them at one point and another at another, and there's a certain arbitrariness about it. Now, I got a shock on these degrees of sin during the Hitler period when a monk in Munich wrote to me and asked me if I could arrange a fake wedding in order to get some Austrian countess out. And I wrote back and I said, Lieber Bruder in Christo, dear brother in Christ, do you want me to play fast and loose with the sacrament of marriage? She said, it wouldn't be marriage, it'd be a fake. Well, I started thinking about it. I had no doubt that he was engaged in faking passports, and I wouldn't have scrupled on faking his passports. And if I was willing to lie to the Nazis, you may say, why wouldn't I be willing to kill? It's just a thing to be thought over. Then I started thinking about this marriage business. I didn't quite see how I could help out very much, but I shifted ground, and I said, I'm representing the American Friends Service Committee in a number of capacities, and if we were to set up a fake marriage to get her in, it would mean deceiving the American government and not just Hitler's government. And you can't both play tricks on the government and work with it. And the American Friends Service Committee is operating under arrangements that have been set up by the American government. And if it's found that I, being connected with them, have pulled a fake on the American government, it will jeopardize the rest of our work. So I really can't arrange this fake wedding. But if it hadn't been for that consideration, I would have thought it over again.
Did you ever approach the American government as to whether they would allow you to pass, you know, make a fake marriage? I mean, if you had told them, I want to do a fake marriage in order to get the Countess out.
Well, I didn't take it up with them. No, I didn't. I'm pretty well sure that they that it wouldn't have gone through. I don't think the American government was willing to engage in trickery like that. Now, there was a somewhat different case of a young American who was unmarried over there, and a girl besought him to marry her, and she said, as soon as you get me to New York, I'll give you a divorce. Well, that would have been taking a little longer than that. And he didn't do it. But it does call to mind all of the ethical compromises and the narrowness of the lines. But I don't think it's legitimate to say, if you would do this, then you must do this and this and this and this and go clear down the line and not dig in your toes anywhere. But I quite agree that people will draw the lines differently. In the First World War, I had a friend who was opposed to the war, but he enlisted for the Merchant Marine. He said that was a non-military operation. Others drew the line somewhere else. Somebody over here was going to comment?
Yeah, you've been speaking mostly historically so far, but I'd like to bring you back a little bit more to the current situation. Because you said that you were you talked about police power,
yes,
versus military power or war. And this intrigued me because it seems that even the line now between what is police power and what is almost war in the streets of one man against his fellow man just because he believes in him is becoming more and more blurred. And I'm wondering if maybe this is in the future something that SEALs will have to consider.
You're perfectly right. It is becoming blurred, and I didn't mean I could approve of anything that the police do. And then, if the police don't handle a situation, we call in the National Guard. And from the we've gone over straight to the military then, and with our police armed, and with their overreaction, as Mayor Daley called it, they're behaving in ways that savor of war. I've been thinking of the British police, who are unarmed and who handle things much more adroitly. You're right, the line becomes a blurred line, and it raises the question as to how much police power one is willing to endorse.
But you can't wage war against the police. I mean, a group cannot get up against the police. War, isn't war a conflict?